Well, in John chapter 7, we see that people start to take a litany of different perspectives on who Jesus is. We pick up in verse 1. After this, Jesus went around in Galilee. He didn't want to go about in Judea because the Jewish leaders there were looking for a way to kill him. The Jewish festival of Tabernacles was near. Remember in chapter 6, verse 4, we read that the Passover had just occurred. So that is March, April of AD 32. Now we moved over to the Feast of Tabernacles, which on the Jewish calendar puts us somewhere in September, October. So 6 months, in other words, have passed since we've just seen what Jesus did in chapter 6. Jesus' brother said to him, Jesus had brothers and at least two sisters, according to the Gospels. His brothers said, why don't you leave Galilee and go to Judea so that your disciples there may see the works that you do? Oh, that's a good burn from his brothers. I don't know if you realize that. John 6, verse 66 said that many of his disciples left him. That sounds like something straight from a brother's mouth. Yeah, why don't you go do your works with all your people following you around? They'll see how great you are. Ouch. No one who wants to become a public figure like you acts in secret. Since you are doing these things, why don't you show yourself to the world? For, John writes, even his own brothers did not believe in him. It's no wonder that at the end of the gospel, I'm going to ruin the story, Jesus gets crucified. And as he's hanging from the cross, he entrusts his mother, not as standard custom would have it, to his brothers. He entrusts his mother to John. Woman, behold your son. Son, behold your mother. Why didn't he entrust his mother, Mary, to his brothers, which was custom? They didn't believe in him. So at that moment, Mary went into John's house. He took care of her as a mother. Yeah. Would be pretty hard to believe that your brother was the Messiah of the world. Later, however, we discover that none other than James, the half-brother of Jesus, becomes a believer in Jesus. Galatians 1:19 counts him among the apostles. Later, we see that he's a pillar of the early church. And then when we get to Acts chapter 21, we see that he is at the center of the church in Jerusalem. So typically, when a failed Messiah was on the scene, you would give the messiahship to the brother. Here, James is still affirming Jesus as the Messiah, the true Messiah. Well, I digress. Verse 6. Therefore, Jesus told them, my time is not yet here. For you, any time will do. What does that mean? Well, just replete throughout the Gospel of John, Jesus keeps saying, my hour is not yet come. What's his hour? His death. So they're planning to kill him. So he's saying, I'm not gonna do that. My time is not yet here. For you, you're not in any danger. Your time is any time. You can do whatever you want. You can go down to the festival. You have the freedom because nobody hates you. Why? He says, the world cannot hate you, but it hates me because I testify that its works are evil. That's why there was such antipathy between Jesus and the religious leaders. You go to the festival. Go ahead. I'm going to go up to this festival. I'm not going to go up to this festival because my time has not fully come. The leaders were setting a trap. So Jesus says, you go ahead. I'm not going to go. And presumably he means yet. So I'm not going at this time. Not that he's never going to go. After he said this, he stayed in Galilee. However, his brothers had left for the festival and they went also, not publicly, but in secret. So Jesus sneaks into the festival of booths, the festival of tabernacles, tents. Now at the festival, the Jewish leaders were watching for Jesus, asking, where is he? It's a trap, in the words of Admiral Akbar. He's here. Where is he? He's got to be here. They always knew whenever there was a bunch of stuff happening, Jesus was going to show up. Where is he? He's going to try and ruin this festival, get the attention on himself. Among the crowds, there was widespread whispering about him. Some of them said, he is a good man. Fair enough. I would agree with that. I think that's true. It doesn't go far enough, though. He is a good man, but is he just merely a good man? Even, you know, critics of the Bible will say that Jesus was a good man. John Stuart Mill, he said about the life and sayings of Jesus, there is a stamp of personal originality combined with profundity of insight. In the very first rank of sublime men of genius, of whom our species can boast. This preeminent genius, he's speaking of Jesus in whom he doesn't believe, right? This preeminent genius is combined with the qualities of probably the greatest moral reformer and martyr to that mission who ever existed upon earth. He is the ideal representative and guide of humanity. When you've got even a hater of Christianity saying you've got nothing on Jesus, that speaks for something. In fact, you should go on the web tonight, I dare you, type in, did Jesus ever sin? All these atheistic websites pop up. You should see what they got on Jesus. Oh man, he spoke with a mean tone at one point. His tone was awful. Yeah, it was real sinful. And then another one, he killed a fig tree. Oh, that poor fig tree. And he ran people out of the temple and stuff. He was protecting the poor and the marginalized. It's just like, you got nothing on Jesus. Nothing. Okay, he's definitely squeaky clean. So people would say, I mean, most people would say he was a good moral teacher. And when you get into discussions with people on any issue, you know, political, philosophical, ethical, everybody wants to get Jesus on their side. Now, why would that be? Because everybody sees the value of this historical person. So many people would say, yes, he is a moral teacher. That's really not debated by and large. However, if he's merely a moral teacher, I've got big, big problems with that. Namely, he claimed to be God. He claimed to be God. For example, just in this book that we're reading, this biography that claims to be eyewitness testimony of Jesus, we read in the very first verse of the first chapter, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. That's speaking of Jesus. John 10:30, I and the Father are one. I mean, even a Bart Ehrman, even a skeptic of Christianity, it's like, that's claiming that Jesus is God. John 20:28, this is the climax of John's gospel. This is like where the crescendo of the orchestra climaxes in this statement, where the skeptic Thomas cries out after he sees the holes in his hands and his feet and his side is scarred, risen from the dead. He cries out, my Lord and my God. So he claimed this over and over. And it's not like Jesus said, no, you misunderstood me. He said, blessed are you who believe. He affirms this. Of course he did. What was Jesus's favorite self-designation? Like maybe you have a nickname or a title or something like that. What was Jesus's favorite self-designation? The Son of Man. And many people mistakenly believe that this refers to Jesus' humanity, the Son of Man. No. This refers to Jesus' deity, the Son of Man. You say, how do you figure? He uses this title, lifting it directly from Daniel chapter 7. This is what we read, Old Testament book. There before me, Daniel says, he's seeing a vision, was one like a Son of Man, coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days, that's God, and was led into his presence. Now, if you know the book of Daniel, you don't worship humans. You don't worship kings. You don't worship emperors. You don't worship Nebuchadnezzar. You don't bow before his 90-foot-tall statue. When the elite in Persia, when they say don't pray, you open the windows. You pray 3 times a day. You pray more. Even if you go into the lion's den, yes, even if you go into the lion's den, you don't bow before human authorities. And yet, right in the midst of Daniel, there was before me one like a Son of Man coming with the clouds, approaching God the Father. He was given, the Son of Man, authority, glory, and sovereign power. All peoples, nations, and men of every language worshiped him. Who is this Son of Man? I mean, this really bothered Jewish commentators for years to look at this and say, how could all the authority, glory, and sovereignty be given to a man and everyone on planet Earth worships him? You're not supposed to worship a man. You're supposed to worship God. Oh, there's our answer. He is God. He is God, coming on the clouds of heaven. At the end of the Gospel of Mark, this is the climax of the Gospel of Mark. Jesus is being really cagey throughout this entire Gospel. Who are you? And he's like, don't talk about it. And, you know, he's revealing himself, but right from the first chapter, all the way through, he's God, but keep it silent. But at the end, when he's on trial, the high priest asks him this. He says, are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One? Jesus said, ego me, I am. This is the translation of the Hebrew Yahweh. In first century Judaism, you didn't say God's name, the tetragrammaton, Yahweh, four letters, YHWH. You didn't say that. But what you would say are things that were kind of similar to it, translations. And he's saying the translation of Yahweh in the Old Testament. I am. And you will see me, the Son of Man, seated in the place of power at God's right hand and coming on the clouds of heaven. That's coming right out of Daniel 7. Oh my God. Then the high priest, he figured out what he was saying. There's no confusion here. He tore his clothing in horror and he said, why do we need other witnesses? You've all heard his blasphemy. What is your verdict? Guilty, they all cried. He deserves to die. One of the things in New Testament studies that bothers critics is why was Jesus of Nazareth crucified? He wasn't a political leader. That's very clear. So what got him up on that cross? Well, in order for the Jewish people, the leaders, to have Jesus killed, you needed to say that he's trying to usurp Rome. So, if he's claiming to be the Messiah, that could be grounds to take it to Pontius Pilate and have him killed. This fits like a hand in a glove right here. There it is. So, he's a good moral teacher. True. But is he merely a good moral teacher? False. Because he also, in addition to teaching ethics and teaching morality, he claimed to be God. How could Jesus give us sound ethical teaching if he made the most egotistical claims about himself? I've had professors that were pretty egotistical. Have you? Narcissistic, maybe? I don't know. Maybe that's too far. But, I mean, they're really full of themselves, you know. They're always patting themselves on the back. And, you know, I don't mind listening to professors like that. Because even though their character issues are all screwy, you know, they can teach me something about physics or history or math, or you know, their character is independent of what they're teaching. But could you have an ethics professor who is egotistical and narcissistic teach you about ethics? No, unless they're just reading from somebody who actually has character. They can't actually do that. So if Jesus is claiming to be God and he's making the ultimate egotistical claim, there is no greater egotistical claim that we can imagine. And if he's claiming this, and he's such a good moral teacher, no. See, I hope you can see. That is out of bounds. You can't just say, well, he's such a good moral teacher, when he claimed to do the most sinful thing ever, claiming to be God himself. Merely a good man, no. Others replied, they were debating. They're like, he's a deceiver. He deceives people. Messiah, no. Menace. Was he a deceiver? Hard to believe, man. Really hard to believe. Deceivers buckle under pressure. Why do deceivers, thieves, liars, why do they do what they do? Why do they steal? Why do they do all this stuff? Namely, because they're trying to get a profit. They're trying to take. So when the pain goes up, the profit isn't worth it. You know, if you get drawn into prison or something and it's you and your buddies and, you know, you're going to give up your buddy, you're going to do anything to get out of jail. And that's in our legal system. In this legal system, you would be crucified, tortured, murdered, butchered. I mean, okay. So he gets right up to the end with total grace, total poise, totally in control. Are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One? I am. And you will see me on the clouds of heaven. He says, yeah, he could have bailed right there. If he was a liar, he could have hit the eject button and got out of there. Instead, he willingly took the steps to the cross. Deceiver, well, they don't defend victims. They victimize the defenseless. And if there's one thing we know about Jesus, it was that he was one who defended the marginalized, the prostitutes, the tax collectors, the poor, the physically infirm, people that were blind. These were his people. And he didn't take anything from them. He didn't steal. He just took care of these people. I mean, that's one of the things we know about Jesus, is that he took care of these people. Now, compare that when you turn on the television, you see these slimy televangelists trying to get people's money. Who are they targeting? They're stealing people's retirements, people that are vulnerable, the poor. Some of these churches are filled with some of the poorest people out there. And they're teaching this health and wealth and prosperity gospel, that you give money and then God will bless your life and make you healthy, happy, and everything else. Jesus doesn't do this. He doesn't take from these people. And deceivers need a sufficient motive. If you're going to go through all this, you need to get something out of it. What would the motive be? Well, let's think of the top three. Money? Yeah, that would explain why somebody would start like an entire movement to get money, to get rich. Jesus never got rich. There's a point where he says, you know, foxes have dens, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. He literally was an itinerant, a traveling teacher. He had nowhere to sleep. He didn't get rich. There's that part where he goes in to pay the temple tax. And he turns to Peter. He's like, you got me? Yeah, I don't have the drachma. So Peter goes out and pays the tax. I'm not saying that Jesus was like abject poor, but I'm saying he never got rich. No way. What about power? Yeah, that's where a lot of deceivers, if they're going to start a movement, that's what they do. They're always reaching for power. They like to be worshiped. They love the attention. How does that fit with Jesus? We just read in John 6:15 that they were trying to take him by force to make him their king. And he slipped away. Here's your moment. And he said no. Later, we're going to read when he's in front of Pilate, where he says, don't have a kingdom that's of this earth. If I did, my followers would pick up swords. They would fight. He wasn't into any kind of a power grab. Nothing like that. Sex. Yeah, that's usually the one people go to. If it's not money and you're getting, you know, rich, if it's not power and you have influence, it's got to be something, usually sex, usually all three. Let's be honest. Let me tell you this. There is one thing on which critics and Christian scholars agree. I mean, on the most crazy spectrum, you know, like John Dominic Crossan, he's like out in the parking lot, critical. That's how bad he is. Okay. Everyone agrees that Jesus didn't have a wife. Jesus didn't have a girlfriend. He didn't have a side girl, nothing like that. He was not dating. He was not getting sex on the side. Instead, he had women disciples, and those women disciples, he treated them with the utmost respect, teaching them the scriptures in a day when women were not even allowed to be around the rabbis. So when you've got a consensus in Christian scholarship and a non-Christian scholarship, New Testament, where they're like, wasn't sex, wasn't power, wasn't money. What was it? What was the motive? I don't buy it. Good man, deceiver. Well, no one would say anything publicly about him for fear of the leaders. Not until halfway through the festival did Jesus go up to the temple courts and begin to teach. The festival of booths was 8 days long. So we're at about day 4. The Jewish people there were amazed at Jesus and they asked, how did this man get such learning without having been taught? Taught officially, like taught in the official rabbinic schools. Jesus was self-taught. He learned as a little boy, I'm sure. We don't have information on this, but he wasn't taught under a Gamaliel, you know, or under a Hillel, or one of these big rabbis that would take you on as a personal disciple. But they're looking at Jesus and they're going, wow, this guy is brilliant. He knows the scriptures backward and forward. You know, there's only one place in the Bible where Jesus reads from the Bible? Luke 4, pulls out the Isaiah scroll, reads Isaiah 61. Every other time, Jesus cites the scriptures from memory. Think about that. Next time you pull out your iPhone to look at Bible Gateway, you know, I don't really remember what that was. Jesus just had it in his memory. He could just cite it right off the top of his head. How did he get such incredible learning? Jesus answered, he said, my teaching is not my own. It comes from the one who sent me. Anyone who chooses to do the will of God will find out whether my teaching comes from God or whether I speak on my own. So they're challenging him as a teacher. He's challenging them as a student. If anyone's willing to do God's will, boy, that's a different picture. A lot of people start to explore what they believe about spirituality, and they sort of approach it like it's some kind of a purely rationalistic game. Sometimes you get into discussions and it almost feels like volleyball, like you're just trying to outsmart each other or something. It's real weird. And people approach this like it's something out there on the blackboard, you know, that, you know, we write down and we think about it's out there. And Jesus is like, it is that. And it's also, are you willing? Are you willing? If this was true, if Christianity was true, would you be willing to become a follower of Jesus of Nazareth? I've heard people say no to that question. If it's true, would you follow Jesus? No. Well, that about says it all. If you don't have the intellectual integrity to say, if this is real, that I would follow it, then what are you going to do? Watch Disney movies for the rest of your life? Live in a fantasy world where we don't care about truth? Of course we care about truth. Don't you want to know what's real, what's actually there? Question is, are you willing? If you're willing and you actually choose to follow Jesus, he says, God will make this known to you. There's an addition, not just to reason and evidence, but a personal experience. I found this. I remember coming to faith in Jesus. And boy, I remember Jesus said in Matthew 17, all you need is the faith of a mustard seed. That's about all I had. If you're there, I think you're there. Not quite sure, but if you are, I think you're there. I pray that you would come into my life, forgive my sins. And at that moment, I just had this incredible sense of peace. Just that sense of, whoa, that has been done. The biggest decision I'll ever make, ever. Whew, it's done. But I still had my doubts. Still had them. I woke up the next day, they're still there. And what do you do with those? Well, I started following Christ, and you start to see, this isn't just out there. This is in here. I'm starting to experience God in my life. This is incredible. Like, I pray, and he answers my prayers. I speak to people. I can feel myself changing. I see other people changing. How is that happening? Anyone who chooses to do the will of God will find out. The question is, are you willing? Well, Jesus said, whoever speaks on their own does so to gain personal glory. But he who seeks the glory of the one who sent him is a man of truth. Of course, he's speaking of himself. There is no unrighteousness in him. Who else could say that? Anybody? I've never met somebody. I've talked to a lot of people and I've said to them, you know, so what do you think about spiritual things? Is there a spiritual side to you? And then we'll get to the question of guilt. Like, what do you do with your guilt? You know what I've never heard from anybody? What guilt? Everybody knows what we're talking about. Oh, yeah, there's guilt. Jesus, if you said, what do you do with your guilt? He would literally be like, I don't have any guilt. There is no unrighteousness in him. How could he have the audacity to say that? His brothers were there. His family was there. His disciples were there. Nothing stuck to him. No unrighteousness in him. Has not Moses given you the law? Yet not one of you keeps the law. You're trying to kill me. Yeah, remember that commandment? Thou shalt not kill. You have the law. You don't keep it. The crowd replied, you are demon-possessed. Who's trying to kill you? Yeah, that's what they call gaslighting. Nobody's trying to kill you. You're crazy. You got your demon-possessed. Later in John 10, we see he has a demon and is insane. See, in this culture, if you were had a mental illness, they would say, well, you're demon-possessed. So, and then there also is demon possession too. So how do we adjudicate between those two things? Well, that's a subject for another night. But in this culture, they just melded all that right together. You must be insane, demon-possessed. Crazy. So Messiah, not the Messiah, mentally ill. Let's think about this here. Some people will say, okay, it doesn't make sense that he's a good moral teacher. Doesn't make sense that he's a deceiver, a menace. Maybe he's a maniac. Maybe he's mentally ill. Boy, that's really hard to believe. Some people try and downplay this. They're like, yeah, he claimed to be God. Obviously, he claimed to be God. Our earliest sources say that he claimed to be God. And yet, maybe it's like God with a little g. You know what I mean? Like some people will say that they're God and it's like the spark of the divine within you. No, 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 no. That's totally first century American culture. That's what you're thinking of. Don't import that back onto a first century Jewish culture. They didn't have this whole Western, Eastern, spark of the divinity, any of that stuff. They believed in God with a capital G, the infinite personal God. And Jesus was claiming this, all of these divine rights and honors for himself. He's saying, I am in human flesh and I'm God. Peter Kraft, he's a, I don't know if he's still teaching. He's out at Boston College. He said this, he said, quote, a measure of your insanity is the size of the gap between what you think you are and what you really are. If I came in here tonight and I said that, you know, I could have played Division I basketball, you'd say he's a little bit insane, right? If I came in here and I said, you know, I'm a congressman, you'd say, well, he's a lot insane. If I came in here and I said, je suis Napoleon, which is French for I am Napoleon, you'd say, this guy, well, there's a huge gap. Me and playing, you know, college basketball, maybe I could fake it or something. Me being a congressman, no way. Okay, me being Napoleon, that's, whoa, what you think you are versus what you really are. That's so far away. You see what Kraft is saying here? If you are broadening that chasm to the point where you're not saying I'm a D1 player, I'm Napoleon, but I'm God, that is absolutely off the farm, bonkers, insane. That is megalomania, rock star complex out into infinity. There's nothing like a claim like this. The absolute insanity of claiming to be God. Is that the case? It's interesting. It's interesting. The New Testament includes this accusation. In other words, the disciples were so confident in Jesus, they didn't mind including this, that he was accused of being insane. How about that? So they weren't trying to dress up the Gospels. Instead, what they were doing was saying, actually, this guy is so rock solid. We even have quotes from the family where it says the family of Jesus thought that he was crazy. Mark 3:21. Go home and read it. It's in there. You're like, that's embarrassing. That's my point. You would never put that in the account of your founder unless you believed this was actually had no merit whatsoever. Another problem I have with this is thinking, you're telling me over the last 20 centuries, the world was transformed by a delusional, narcissistic maniac. I mean, we're talking billions of people. Ancient people, pre-modern, post-modern, modern, having their hearts, having their lives changed. You'd have to explain to me, how is it somebody gets off alcohol addiction? Somebody gets off of drugs? How somebody who, you know, is a terrible dad, workaholic, all of a sudden becomes a loving father? How people, you know, have been rescued from prostitution, from, I mean, we're talking about the extremes. What about just people that are just relatively selfish and their lives are changed into outward people? You're telling me, you're going to tell me that this was all from a mentally ill man, that his teachings have transformed the world. More hospitals, more schools, more philanthropic organizations have been founded directly from the person of Jesus of Nazareth. Boy, that's just so hard to believe. That would stretch my credulity just to the point where it just snaps. I just cannot believe that. There was a book back in 2013. This is published by Oxford University Press, where they said, who is the biggest, most influential person in human history? They looked at all the different data. They came to the conclusion, Jesus. Jesus is at the fountainhead of the human race, more impactful than any other. And we're here saying that he was actually mentally ill. Boy. To be clear, psychotic megalomaniacs, they're really not that hard to identify. I'm doing Christian ministry for a little while, and I serve all kinds of people, some of whom have mental disability or mental instability, sometimes real bad, not in touch with reality. And you can pick up on it very quickly. This is not that difficult. Here's an example. Here was the most successful cult leader in getting people to commit suicide on American soil. His name was Marshall Applewhite. This is relatively modern, 1997. He was the most successful. He got 39 people to kill themselves. Here's his video right here.
We'll title this tape, Planet Earth About to Be Recycled. Your only chance to evacuate is to leave with us. Planet Earth About to Be Recycled. These that are sitting before me have been students of T and O. T, my father, have been students of T and O, are still students of T and O, even though T returned to the heavens in 1985. And T is my heavenly father. Gave me birth into that kingdom before this civilization began.
Anybody confused at all? I'm not. He didn't blink that whole time. This is not hard to tell. I mean, I'm not an expert in psychology or anything. It's not hard. And to have the kind of megalomania, totally out of touch with reality, to say that you're God, far more insane than this guy. Finally, Jesus' closest disciples went to their deaths believing in him. That's hard to believe. You know, Paul, an educated Jewish Roman man, went to his death. He was beheaded in Rome in the AD 60s. We have very good historical authority on this. James, the brother of Jesus, isn't mentioned in the New Testament, not his death. He's mentioned extra-biblically by Josephus, non-Christian, book 20, section 200, that it says that James was killed for believing in Jesus, the so-called Messiah. He was bludgeoned, he was thrown off a tower, and then they brutally beat him to death with rocks. Peter, his closest disciple, he was with him all 3.5 years. He was crucified in Rome. Crucified. So all these guys went to their deaths, his closest disciples, believing. Now, how much would it take for you to believe that your best friend is the Messiah, the Savior of the world? How much would it take for you to believe it was your brother? Oh, boy. And to go to your death for this. I don't buy it. I don't believe it. I can't believe that. So, good man, good moral teacher, deceiver, deceived. Well, the whole crowd is just debating this. They're in a murmur. Jesus, still teaching in the temple courts, cried out, "Yes, you know me, and you know where I'm from. I am not here on my own authority, but he who sent me is true. You do not know him, but I know him, because I am from him, and he sent me." Well, at this, they tried to seize Jesus, but no one laid a hand on him, because his hour had not yet come. Still, many in the crowd believed in him. They said, "When the Messiah comes, will he perform more signs than this man here?" Finally, on the last and greatest day of the Jewish festival of tabernacles, Jesus stood. Rabbis don't stand. Rabbis sit. When a rabbi teaches, they sit. Jesus stands for this one. That's how you know you're about to get it, all right? Jesus stands up. Now, the Jewish festival of tabernacles, what's this? From extra-biblical literature, from Judaism, 8 days, days 1 through 6, there was an entire ceremony where you lived out in a tent with your family. Actually sounds pretty fun. Just for a week out of the year, you get to go camping. And they would take water from the Pool of Siloam to the temple. And then they would sing a part of the Psalms. And then they bring it to the priest. And you would pour out their water all over the altar. Every day, you take this water, take it to the temple, sing. the Hillel, and every day, bring it again. Day one, day two, day six. Day seven, the party was at its peak. This is where people were just going crazy. They're having fun. I mean, just picture a huge block party. Only, you know, you're out in nature, you're together, it's with all your best friends, family. They're having a blast. But day eight, no more water. No more singing. Totally somber. And here's the kicker. The rabbis taught that on day eight, Messiah would come and bring water to the people. And Jesus stood. And he said this. In a loud voice, the Greek here is a shriek, a scream. He must have had some pipes. He yells this, okay? Let anyone who is thirsty come to me and drink. Whoever believes in me, as the scripture has said, rivers of living water will flow from within them. So it's not just physical water. This is parallel to believing in him. And when you come to believe in Messiah, your life is changed. Just to think on that final day, everybody's somber, this real dour atmosphere and sad, and we don't have any, we're probably thirsty. They're not moving the water around. And Jesus says, anyone thirsty? Yeah. Come to me and drink. Get that thirst quenched. Well, when Jesus said living water, he was speaking of the Holy Spirit who would be given to everyone believing in him. But the Spirit had not yet been given because Jesus had not yet entered into his glory. To have the Holy Spirit come into your heart. The Spirit of God becoming one spirit with you. Oh, I can't explain this. You just have to do it. To experience God in your life, in your body, is like nothing else. The way he describes it, it's like water pouring up out of your soul. On hearing his words, some of the people said, surely this man is the prophet. Others said, he is the Messiah. Thus the people were divided because of Jesus. Well, we're probably divided too. You could be sitting here thinking, well, that was a lot to think about. Not really. Did Jesus claim to be God? There's excellent historical grounds for this. Yes, he did. Now, that claim is either false or it's true. Either he claimed this or he didn't. If it's false, was he insincere? Okay, if he's insincere, then he was a liar. It's like not true that Jesus was God. Well, if he's insincere, like if he was deceived, then he's a liar. If he was sincere, that makes him a lunatic. But here's the question. I don't believe he was a liar. I don't think he was a lunatic. What does that mean if this claim was true? Well, you'll have to think about that on your own time.